Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, March 13th, 2018. I remember the good old days before Trump, where every now and then we had a slow news day. Once again, I struggle to bring you my 10-story briefing in half an hour of the important events of the day. I'll see if I can do it in half an hour. Please indulge me if we run a little long. That's been happening a lot lately. So Donald Trump used Twitter to notify his Secretary of State, Rexxon Tillerson, that his services are no longer required. And it sets in motion a game of musical chairs that we'll detail for you in a moment. But the other big story of the last 24 hours broke late on Monday, when the Republican leaders of the House Intelligence Committee, and Mike Conaway is substituting for the impaired and partly recused Devin Nunes, Conaway announced that they are suspending, they are ending the investigation into Russiagate because they have found no evidence of collusion between Trump and the Russian government. Now, I haven't found any evidence of collusion either, but it is a highly partisan, limited hangout decision here, where they're trying to say, look, we spent a year struggling with this, and we went out to Langley at the CIA and looked at the raw intelligence, and by golly, those guys got it wrong. Russia did interfere, they say, but not to help Trump, just as part of their general development of chaos on these shores. Conaway said the Russians did commit active measures against our election in 2016, and I think they'll do that in the future. But we disagree with the narrative that they were trying to help Trump. Now, I have argued and I continue to maintain this bizarre position. I know many people, including close friends, are saying, Peter, where the hell are you at on this Russiagate thing? Well, I believe that Trump is dirty with Russians, that there were, as I shared with Scott Ritter and later last week with Peter Van Buren in a pair of what I think are very strong in-depth interviews, that Trump surrounded himself with corrupt people who had their own schemes. Manafort joined the campaign to try to retire his huge debt with a Russian oligarch. Mike Flynn joined the campaign so that he could cash in with a $500,000 consulting deal with a businessman related to Turkey. Jared Kushner has been using his post in the White House to try to refinance his family's business empire. And yes, I believe there has been obstruction of justice. And so it puts me in a curious position. I don't think these Republicans ever intended to do anything but produce a whitewash in favor of Trump. And likewise, the Democrats have been running a highly partisan operation on their side of the House Intelligence Committee. It's interesting, last night I was out in San Francisco at a movie screening, and so I listened to CNN and Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell on my satellite radio in the car. That was enhanced by the fact that there was a fatal accident on the Golden Gate Bridge that left me stalled for an extra almost an hour. Anyway, I absorbed a lot of the reaction to this. And while I do agree that there is no public evidence that Trump and Russian government officials colluded, I also don't believe that there has been an honest investigation. And we've got Bob Mueller, the special counsel, working on the criminal probe. And, of course, I never had much of an investment in the House or Senate Intelligence Committee investigations. There hasn't been an honest government oversight commission or committee, really, since the Pike and the going back to the 1970s, it was the Pike and the Church Commissions. They revealed deep wrongdoing by the FBI and the CIA, and at least for public consumption, there were some corrective measures taken. And, of course, Trump couldn't wait. He tweeted out in all caps. The House Intelligence Committee has, after a 14-month-long in-depth investigation, found no evidence of collusion or coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia to influence the 2016 presidential election. The acting chair of the committee, Conaway, said they would be turning over a 150-page draft report to Democrats today. They didn't even bother to tell them they were taking this step. They told reporters before they briefed their Democratic co-committee members. And they're also preparing an in-depth analysis of the intelligence community's January 2017 assessment. Conaway, we found no evidence of collusion. We found perhaps some bad judgment, inappropriate meetings. But only Tom Clancy or someone else like that could take this series of inadvertent contacts with each other, or meetings, whatever, and weave that into some sort of fictional page-turner spy thriller. But it's fair to say that the Democrats have many legitimate complaints. And Adam Schiff ticked them off that there are many witnesses that we would either like to call or recall. And that there are developing stories like George Nader, this guy who's a Lebanese-American businessman, advisor to the United Arab Emirates, was in the Seychelles when the secret meeting with Eric Prince took place. That's all interesting. But Max Boot, who was a big promoter of George W. Bush and the war in Iraq, part of the Project for a New American Century, a dyed-in-the-wool neocon. Max Boot has been on the other side of this, a Trump critic, for some time now, and the Washington Post allowed him to publish an op-ed today. And he does the kind of ritual denunciation here. After spending the last year pretending to investigate connections between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign, the Republican-led House Intelligence Committee ended the charade Monday by announcing there was no evidence of collusion. Even more incredibly, the GOP majority said there was no evidence that the Russians, whoever that means, had been trying to elect President Trump, an assertion contradicted by the U.S. intelligence community and by a federal grand jury that indicted 13 Russians for alleged involvement. Now, that is such a stretch. We know the 13 people indicted from St. Petersburg were working in a clickbait troll operation. Were they tied to Putin? Only by circumstantial evidence. And that's the key term here. And Max Boot admitted and acknowledges it in this op-ed. He says, you know, what might the Republicans have found if they were really interested in looking? He said, well, a recent summary by the Washington Post provides compelling, if circumstantial, evidence of collusion. Then he spends a page and a half on that circumstantial evidence. No mention of the U.S. media tilting for Trump, but he highlights the claim that on Facebook, 126 million Americans were subjected to a Kremlin propaganda blitz. That's such a phony number. It's 126 million impressions out of trillions. No mention of Trump's $80 million investment in Facebook paid postings. No mention of David Brock's troll farm run on behalf of the Clinton campaign. And so we continue to get very partisan perspectives on this entire issue. And get this. We're told that the Mueller special counsel operation is solid, disciplined, and leak-proof. So, Bloomberg got a really nice leak from somebody on the Mueller team indicating that the counsel has been is about to wrap up his obstruction of justice case against Trump. And I think that's a very strong case. And that he may put it aside and wait to file charges until he finishes other parts of the investigation. If he files charges now, the speculation is he might face pressure from Trump and his allies to conclude the investigation, and witnesses may be less cooperative with other elements of the probe. And here's the indication of where it leaked from. According to current and former U.S. officials who spoke to Bloomberg, No names, please. Regardless of what he uncovers in the obstruction case, Mueller might make it a priority to keep his findings secret as he continues with other portions of the investigation. Now, where's this leak coming from, who's it intended for, and what is the real message here? You can work on those questions, okay? Then there's Roger Stone. He's being trotted out as kind of the latest person of interest in these investigations. And he's a wily character. He lies with abandon. And he has made claims that he was in contact with WikiLeaks in 2016. He famously told one person in a phone call, this is not so famous, by the way, this is an unnamed source who claims to have been on the other end of the call with Roger Stone, but this was in April or so of 2016, and he told this person that he had learned from Julian Assange that WikiLeaks had obtained emails that would torment senior Democrats such as Podesta, the campaign chairman, and this could have been fabricated by Roger Stone. We don't know what he has told investigators and whether they consider what he has said to be a lie or just various things that he has said to other people. Now, Roger Stone says that when it comes to Sam Nunberg, this guy who was he spent last week on television saying that he would reject a subpoena from Mueller, and then he went and spoke to the grand jury on Friday. And Stone is quoted as saying that in trying to get Nunberg off the phone, he joked, he said, "I think I'll go to London for the weekend and meet with Julian Assange. The idea that I would meet with Assange undetected is ridiculous on its face," he says. So WikiLeaks and Assange have repeatedly said that they never communicated with Stone. And in a tweet, here's one from Assange, "A message telling Roger Stone to cease falsely suggesting contact with WikiLeaks is now the claim proof that Roger Stone had contact with WikiLeaks when it proves what I've said all along?" Yeah, that is kind of mysterious. Next, we look at the shuffling of the deck chairs on the Trump ship. And it is amazing that Tillerson has known for a long time that he was in a tenuous position. It was thought that he might leave the administration at the end of last year. But he learned he had been fired this morning when a top aide showed him a tweet from Trump announcing the change. And it turns out that he'd gotten an indirect warning from the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, who called him to tell him to cut short a trip to Africa and advised him, "You may get a tweet." So there was some indication that Tillerson, this would be coming. And a senior administration official said Trump decided to place Tillerson, to replace Tillerson now, to have a new team in place before the upcoming talks with North Korea. So some people speculate that because Tillerson made a comment supporting the Prime Minister of Britain's claim that Russia was responsible for the nerve agent that allegedly poisoned a former double agent spy who was living in Britain. We'll get to that story in a few minutes. I don't think that was the proximate cause. I think that this was in the works. So now we look at the new Secretary of State designated. He has to be confirmed by the Senate, and that is Mike Pompeo, currently the CIA director. And he, of course, is a guy who supports Trump's America First ideas. He is a hardline right-winger. He comes out of Kansas, and we'll detail his connection to the Koch brothers in just a moment. But as I pointed out yesterday, Trump's task here is to win the trust of North Korea and get them to sign on to some sort of a nuclear disarmament deal at the same time that Trump wants to shred the six-nation deal with Iran. And Mike Pompeo is good with both of those objectives. And as I raised yesterday, the big question is, will the United States under this administration respond to the Russian calls for new arms reduction talks with the United States? So Mike Pompeo is a guy who does, I think, fit more comfortably into Trump's bizarre worldview. But it's going to be interesting to see how all of this plays out. Now, a little more on the Tillerson departure. This last week for him was a monster. He only served 405 days as Secretary of State, and in the last week or so, he was crisscrossing Africa on what I call the shithole apology tour. And he was out there trying to reassure these nations that, despite Trump's comments, that the U.S. is their strong ally. So while he's on the shithole apology tour, he took a day off last week to recover from what the State Department said was exhaustion after long nights catching up by phone with Washington. Then he got food poisoning, cut his travel short, and was fired upon returning to the United States. That's a lovely way that Trump treats his people, isn't it? So the Koch brothers are the real mentors of Mike Pompeo. Yes, Pompeo is the greatest beneficiary of Koch Industries' largesse. When he first started in Congress about 8 years ago, he was referred to as the Koch brothers congressman, the congressman from Koch, and John Nichols from The Nation, who profiled all of the members of the Trump administration. It's the Horseman of the Trumpocalypse is the name of his book. He says Pompeo's pattern of deference to his political benefactors is likely to make him a better fit with a self-absorbed president. He'll also bring to the position an edge that Tillerson lacked. Pompeo is a foreign policy hawk who fiercely opposed the Iran nuclear deal, stoked fears about Muslims in the United States, opposed closing Guantanamo, defended the NSA's unconstitutional security surveillance programs, and has gone so far to say that Ed Snowden should be brought back from Russia and given due process, and I think the proper outcome would be that he would be given a death sentence. And when he ran for Congress in 2010, he was the largest single recipient of campaign funds from Der Koch Brothers. And this musical chairs creates an opening for a CIA director. And Trump, who was in Pennsylvania last week bragging about how much he loves women and women love him and they support him politically, he decided to nominate a woman to run the CIA. She also has the distinction of being the first person with a history of directly being involved in torture to be promoted to CIA boss, subject to Senate confirmation. So I turned to John Kiriakou, and I've linked to his article from a year ago when Gina Haspel, that's her name, was promoted to deputy director of the CIA, and most Democrats supported that. Well, she is known inside the agency as Bloody Gina, and we have John Kiriakou, who wrote the book about his capture of Abu Zubaydah. And Abu Zubaydah was the man taken to a black site in Thailand, and he was waterboarded 82 times. It was Haspel, who was CIA Deputy Director Jose Rodriguez, handpicked warden of the first secret prison the CIA created. It was Haspel who oversaw the staff, including discredited contract psychologists Mitchell and Jessen. It was Haspel who videotaped the torture of Abu Zubaydah. It was Haspel who carried out Rodriguez's instructions to destroy the tapes, despite being specifically told by the White House counsel to preserve them. And Glenn Greenwald, in a quick post that also reprises an older article at The Intercept today, he quoted a Washington Post reporter, Greg Miller, saying that Haspel was directly involved in the controversial interrogation program, had an extensive role in torturing detainees. She'd run that secret prison in Thailand. And the question that really comes up here is, will Dianne Feinstein block her nomination to be CIA director? Now, to her credit, Feinstein, who has got a challenge for re-election this year, and it has changed her demeanor a bit for the better, she blocked the promotion of Haspel to deputy CIA director a few years back. And, of course, she struggled to get her own torture report published, and it remains to be seen whether Dianne Feinstein still cares about torture and will champion these issues in Senate confirmation hearings coming up. There's a must-read, and it was our friend Carl Howard in Columbus, Ohio, who tipped me off to the World Socialist website's three-part series called The CIA Takeover of the Democratic Party. And Patrick Martin has done a great job here of very carefully reviewing all of the candidates running as challengers for Congress for the House of Representatives this year. And what we learn is that the largest single group of these candidates are people with military and intelligence backgrounds. People like Tom Malinowski. He is a former congressional aide. He ran the Washington Office of Human Rights Watch, and then he joined the administration of Obama, working for John Kerry as Assistant Secretary of State. He's one of the more benign members of this class, and he is running, as I mentioned, for a House seat in New Jersey. How about Jessica Morse? She was a RAC country coordinator for the State Department, and she also worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development, a longtime CIA front, advisor to the U.S. Pacific Command, and she's running here in California against Tom McClintock, a hardline Republican. And the names in here are fascinating. One of them is a guy named Matt Riehl, who is running for the open seat in Tennessee, the 7th District. But he is on a secret mission for the Pentagon right now, and he's not allowed to tell his campaign where he is. He can't coordinate with his campaign until he gets back. Amy McGrath is running in Kentucky in the 6th Congressional District. She's a fighter pilot, and I've seen the TV commercial where she, you know, basically burnishes those credentials. And here's the real disappointing piece of this analysis. Only 5 of the 221 candidates reviewed in this study have links to Sanders or bill themselves as progressives. And Martin says, based on his study, none is likely to win the primary, let alone the general election. So I encourage you to read this. It is really chilling. And as we see Trump pack the government, move a CIA director to Secretary of State, the Democrats are making parallel moves. And I think most people are largely unaware of it. Many people know about the Daily Kos. I stopped reading it a long time ago. It's just Democratic hacks trying to one-up each other with little bits of information that they turn into kind of political propaganda. But there's an interesting piece at BuzzFeed today that Marcos Melitzis, the founder of the Daily Kos, he also headed a startup that became Vox Media. Well, his latest is a 5-year project, a polling project called Civics, spelled C-I-V-I-Q-S. And he is he's polling nearly a million people. A part of that group every day takes an online survey. And so he believes he's got great data. For example, that the shift in suburban white women on gun control is a positive sign that could lead to a long-term shift by Republicans. But buried in this story is advice based on the data that Melitzis has collected that Democrats should shut up about impeaching the president. Melitzis says if you run against Trump and you put him on the ballot, you risk bringing out more Republicans. Talking about impeachment puts Donald Trump on the ballot. My argument would be to run against Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. They're very unpopular, and they depress the Republican base. Keep Donald Trump off the ballot to the extent possible. This is exactly the wrong advice. Sure, I believe that the data lead Melitzis in that direction. But leadership is the factor that's missing. And we also have leadership that is tainted, that is unfortunately poisoned. And you may know that I've known Nancy Pelosi since she first went to Congress in the 1980s. I worked on her campaign in 1996. I personally like her a lot, and I respect what she has done in building her own leadership credentials and serving as the first female speaker. These are historic achievements. But in an op-ed today at The Guardian, Walter Shapiro gently points out that Pelosi is highly unpopular, her approval rating nationally is 29%, and unfortunately, she is extremely well-known. 83% of voters know who she is, and that makes her the punching bag in this special election near Pittsburgh right now, Conor Lamb versus Trump's guy. And the bottom line is that she is more of a liability to the Democratic Party. Now, I know she raises boatloads of money, but that money propels the Democratic Party into the intelligence arena, into the corporate arena. And Shapiro ends by saying selfless decisions are rare in American politics these days, but no matter how the Pennsylvania returns come in Tuesday night, Nancy Pelosi needs to accept the reality that the Democrats are stronger without her. And here's one example. Democrats in the Senate are selling out over the CRAPO banking reform bill, which I intentionally mispronounce as CRAPO. And David Dayen's been doing a great job covering this at The Intercept. And Tim Kaine, remember him? He was the vice presidential candidate in 2016. And before he became a politician, he was a fair lending attorney. And he's leading an effort over an amendment that he hopes never gets a vote, which would narrow the banks exempted from disclosing information that identifies lending discrimination. And Tim Kaine sponsored this measure. It is really just a face-saving gesture that would change things a little bit. Dayen points out if the Democrats were truly interested in reversing this Section 104, they could just strike it. And they have the votes to pull it off. But they're not doing that. And last night, the Senate moved to end debate on the amendment by a 66-30 count. That means that this bill is going to get passed this week, and we're going to regret it for a long, long time. Every day I pause for a second to thank people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Brian Mazzi, Benny Alto, Arlene Montemarano, and David Radcliffe just renewed the annual subscription. Thanks, David. I really appreciate it. I'd like to recruit you to become a subscriber, too. Just visit peterbcollins.com on any device, any browser, click the menu button, then click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and you can take out a subscription that fits your budget. The controversies continue over who's responsible for the alleged nerve agent poisoning of the former double agent named Skripal. This occurred in Salisbury, England, and as we mentioned yesterday, Theresa May, the Prime Minister, all but blamed Russia for it and gave them until tomorrow at noon to prove they didn't do it. That's a tall task. But I found an article at consortiumnews.com written by who I presume is an Australian lawyer. His name is James O'Neill. And he raises some interesting questions, such as if the Russians wanted to kill him, they had many years that they could have. He's been living in England for 8 years in what's called retirement. But they decided that this is the time, right before Putin's re-election in Russia. And also, it's interesting to note that Salisbury is only 12 kilometers from Porton Down, the principal research center for nerve agents in Britain. And Skripal is tied into a former British spy named Pablo Miller, who now works with Christopher Steele at Orbis Business Intelligence. Now, I'm not going to spin anything further out of that, but it does create possible scenarios where Christopher Steele's work is the reason that this nerve agent was given to Skripal, some sort of a brushback kind of message. Or maybe Skripal was one of the sources for Christopher Steele's dossier, and the Russians know that. Those are just theories. But Theresa May's comments, and I noted yesterday that she used spy lingo, are taken apart by Craig Murray, who is an ally, of course, of Julian Assange. He says, the same people who assured you that Saddam Hussein had WMDs now assure you that Russian Novichok nerve agents are being wielded by Vladimir Putin to attack people on British soil. He says it's essential to comb the evidence very finely. A vital missing word from Theresa May's statement yesterday was only. She did not state that the nerve agent used was manufactured only by Russia. And it's also interesting to note that Russia is a signatory to the Chemical Weapons Treaty and says that it has destroyed all of its chemical arsenals. But if you go back to the Soviet era, one of the key manufacturing sites was in Uzbekistan at a place called Nukus, Love that name. And Uzbekistan has been working with the government of the United States to dismantle and decontaminate the sites where the Novichok agents and other chemical weapons were tested and deployed. Again, I don't consider this to be any kind of a conclusion, just important questions that need to be addressed. Yesterday, they frog-marched a guy out of the White House who has been Trump's body man. His name is John McEntee. He's a former college football star, and he's just been the personal assistant for Trump. But whatever caused, they say his security clearance was revoked, and they made him leave the White House immediately. They wouldn't even let him go back to get his coat. And he has been frog-marched over to the Trump re-election campaign, where he's been assured a position. I can't explain it, but that's what we know. Donald Trump is on a photo op visit to California, and also he's doing a campaign stop to pick up cash in Beverly Hills. But about now, he's down in Otay Mesa, hard along the Mexican border, with this photo op of prototypes of his border wall. And I don't have much more to say about that, except it's all stupid. Trump will likely repeat many of the lies and exaggerations that he has used about immigrants in the past. And it's interesting, because when he dove into the recent issues here in San Francisco and he demonized Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf because she gave a warning about an ICE raid, and Trump claimed that 800 or 1,000 criminals were on the loose as a result. Well, the mouthpiece, the FLAC, the public information officer for ICE in San Francisco, quit. His name is James Schwab. He said he wanted the agency to correct the errors that have been advanced by Trump and by Attorney General Jefferson Beauregard Sessions. I was corrected. His name is not Jeffrey. It's Jefferson. And anyway, Schwab, who has morals, says, "I quit because I didn't want to perpetuate misleading facts." He's 38 years old. He said, "I asked them to change the information. I told them the information was wrong. They asked me to deflect, and I didn't agree with that, so I quit. I didn't feel like fabricating the truth to defend ourselves. We're never going to pick up that many people. To say 100% are dangerous criminals on the street, or that those who weren't picked up because of the misguided actions of the mayor, that's just wrong. I've never been in a situation where I've been asked to ignore the facts because it was more convenient. It was my first time being asked to do that." A couple of quickies here before I already probably have run over time, but here we go. There was a roadside bomb blast in Gaza this morning, damaging several vehicles in the convoy of the Palestinian Authority's Prime Minister, Rami Hamdallah, who was not injured. But this indicates that either that's a false flag provocative action, or the struggle between Fatah and Hamas continues. Ahmad Sheikhzadeh is a naturalized American of Iranian origin, and he has a doctorate from Columbia University, a network of prominent contacts. And last year in March, FBI agents came to his hotel room. They came to his house, and then they took him to a hotel room where they kept him overnight. And they basically said, "You have committed tax fraud. You've taken cash payments that you didn't report." He said, "That's right." He didn't lie to the FBI. But then they tried to flip him to become an informant, and he refused. They tried again and again, and they ratcheted up the efforts to pressure him to become an informant. And he refused. They insisted on $3 million bail and an ankle bracelet, but he surprised them and took the stand just before sentencing. He said, "I was not a spy or undercover agent. I did not hide my activity or my work at the Iranian mission." And the judge in the case said, "I feel like I'm missing whatever it is the government is trying to convey to me. I cannot figure out for the life of me what it is you think he is doing or what you think he did." So she took off the bracelet. She gave him a minimum 3-month sentence at a minimum security facility. But it shows you, the FBI will go to great lengths to try to force people to become informants. Xi Jinping has been given president-for-life status by the legislature in China. And finally today, I want to commend Vox News. A lot of times I'm put off by the tone of their coverage and by their kind of reflexive pro-American posture. But when we look at news organizations available to Americans, they're one of the few that cover international stories. And Byline Nick Terse, a reliable source on AFRICOM and the U.S. deployments there. His byline is Democratic Republic of Congo, where Nick Terse is reporting on the early stages of a new genocide between ethnic Hema and Lendu communities. And there was a previous genocide where millions of people were killed, and some villages have been attacked in recent weeks. 150,000 people have fled their homes. And I haven't seen a word about this in the major news outlets that I survey every day. Vice also is the first to report that Myanmar's army is building military bases on the sites of villages that were burned out just 6 months ago to expel the persecuted Muslim Rohingya minority. And satellite images show that they're rapidly developing areas that had been Rohingya villages, and they expect Rohingyas to return from refugee camps in Bangladesh to basically live in communities where these military bases have been recently inserted. Well, this is just the latest sorry chapter. And the U.S., the world, they're so busy, distracted by all of Trump's antics, that many people are suffering and dying in large numbers as we respond to tweets and finger-pointing and blame games. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. We give it away free, and you can find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.